This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 14th of February 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 345 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On today's show, we'll be talking to art writer and historian Michael Pepiat about the career of one of his close friends, the artist Francis Bacon, and why Bacon's work, Two Figures, went under the hammer at Christie's this week.
Later on, we'll also hear from the Italian film director Luca Guadagnino about his latest release starring Tilda Swinton and Ralph Fiennes, A Bigger Splash, and how he goes about drawing in some of those big names.
And we'll be joined by Tim Ellison from one of London's newest attractions, the Postal Museum. He'll be telling us about the peculiar historical practice of sending vinegar valentines, a mischievous Valentine's Day delivery likely to leave a sour taste for its recipients.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Tom Edwards will be delivering next week's big stories too, and we'll play some good music as well right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Well, of course, if any of our listeners, or indeed you, Andrew, if anyone woke up with an unsightly brown stone on their pillow, we should say it's Valentine's Day and I just left a chocolate.
That was the vinegar. I thought that was the vinegar being splashed on the pillow.
Happy Valentine's Day, Andrew Tuck. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
Oh, we get to hang out on Valentine's Day. How about that, Rob?
See, the Monocle Weekly is the gift that keeps on giving. That is the sort of shorthand we have for it, don't we, during the week when we're putting the show together. Oh, is it really another Monocle Weekly interview? We go, don't we? But then we at least get to hang out on the big days.
I know.
You know. Easter Sunday, holidays. Valentine's Day, Christmas Day. No, I'm joking. I think we've got a... I don't know whether it's precisely a romantic show lined up, but one of the things I'm pretty certain is going to be sexy, and that's the chat with Luca Guadagnino, director of A Bigger Splash. Sexy times in southern Italy.
And I think there's someone else who's slightly sexy and romantic. Perhaps we should invite him into the studio.
Man, someone turn up the heating in here, or... Oh, no, it's Tom Edwards. But first, for Valentine's Day, a message from our Overseas Bureau.
Tom Edwards's kerfta-sized kernels of knowledge keep Istanbul turning.
What is
Edwards
this?
Is a man with hokum as sweet as a box of locum. Locum.
Here in the Big Apple, Tom's news goes down like a classic Reuben sandwich. Dense, a little bit of a mess, and pretty much all filler.
Big mouthful.
Oh, and did we mention the cheese as well? That's why we love him.
Steamier than a Singaporean summer's eve. Nothing raises our bureau thermostat and brings on the sweats like the sultry tones of Tom Edwards and his hard-hitting news look ahead.
Absolutely obscene.
I wish it wasn't Valentine's. Nolan Giles there. Do you recognise the voice of Nolan Giles, our Singapore editor?
That's burned into my brain forever now.
Genuinely knocking one out.
All we said to them was, would you like to send a Valentine's message to Tom? I'm not sure what your missus is going to think of it.
She must never be allowed to hear this. That was amazing.
There was a sort of Jane Birkin moment in there halfway through, wasn't there? There was a sort of sharp intake of a female breath.
I didn't realise things could happen, but man.
There was a lot of sweaty meat involved there, I think.
Yeah, what was the...
I think it was definitely more Frey Bentos than anything else as well.
Get your chops around that.
Yeah. Happy Valentine's Day, Tom Edwards.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, my God.
He's really...
Should I just leave now?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just kind of becomes
quite profoundly harrowing.
This room's suddenly felt a lot smaller. It feels definitely like we're at least in Studio 2, not Studio 1.
The glass has steamed up a little. Yeah.
It's still like you were digesting that.
Well, yeah, like Ed with getting his chops around a submarine sandwich of news or whatever it was. I don't know. Absolutely horrifying.
I can only
apologise to our listeners wherever they are.
I listen up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, probably by this point.
I think we can do a sort of statistical check on how many listeners there still are at this point.
Yeah.
And we might as well just pack up and go home.
That's the last one it's got.
Anyway, it's nice. Do you have any romantic news for us next week, or is it all just are we going hard?
We're going hard on Valentine's Day. I just, this all sounds on. So wrong.
Come on.
No, I thought we should talk about show. We should talk about European politics, shouldn't we?
Oh, yeah.
Go for it.
That's always...
that kind of talk always gets me thinking about
that's David, a cold shower.
About David Cameron. Mm. The cold shower to end all cold showers. David Cameron, the ruddy face of David Cameron. No, we normally eschew politics on this, but I thought it was rather interesting. We got a big meeting, a European parliamentary meeting on Tuesday. David Cameron's going to be talking about it, and then the European Council meets later in the week on Thursday. And up for discussion at both is horrible portmanteau alert, worse even than Nolan Giles' sweaty reportage.
Sweportage.
Brexit. But that is yeah. what up for discussion, and we've obviously been charting that very closely here in the UK. Mm. It's a sort of European leg of Cameron's journey. And I just think it's really interesting. I think the rhetoric is interesting. I think how Cameron's trying to play this is interesting. I think the response to the Europeans is interesting. So it could be quite a big week. And, you know, I still, my egos, I still can't offer a best guess as to which way.
Oh, I can offer
it's
a best
guess.
I just wish we had a better choice. Right? Well, we'll stay in, but in something that hasn't
changed. Well, yeah, so. I mean, that's true. Yeah. And the sort of the halfway house, the renegotiations seem to all be fairly unconvincing, something of a damp squib. So
yeah, well, there's a lot of people who said that, you know, that Cameron is the leader of a unified voice to stay in. And there's people from all sorts of spheres of politics that will agree with him, irrespective of party politics. But on the other side, there's no one person. There's no one figure.
Oh, it's a
there's
bit not fragmented.
Even one, it's very fragmented. There's no one voice to sort of say, hey, we should be out of here, much to its poverty.
Maybe we should nominate someone. What about Monocle's Andrew Tuck?
No, I'm
the singular voice. No, are you hedging
your
bets?
No, I'm not hedging my bets. I want to stay.
There you go. So you could be a... another yes you can be, campaign you can be inspirer. You and Dave. Yeah. Maybe not. But
it's an interesting thing when someone that is pro-European but not to that extent has to campaign to be in it.
No,
like
exactly.
David Cameron doesn't believe in what he's necessarily campaigning for, but he's terrified of leaving.
Well, and I think he's terrified of potential financial costs. And this was very interesting when we had the Scottish devolution discussion or independence discussion. It seemed that finance was something that scared people at the last.
I kind of think so. Yeah, I think what's interesting, and I'm not sure if it's a generational thing, but I think there's also a cultural thing that people like or don't like about it. And that's the bit that people don't really want to debate. So it keeps on coming back to, you know, would you be better off being in? Would you be better off being out? What's it going to do for jobs? What would it do for our national security, etc.? But in the end, I think it's a bit of an emotional tug for many people, whether they like it or not. Now, the fact is that there's over a million Britons who have homes in the likes of Spain. Now, what happens to those people if we leave the EU? Are they all going to have to come home? What happens to their kind of residency? And in fact, in their wake, there's loads of people who actually, whether they like it or not, they've kind of eased into a European kind of life. They may not recognise it as such. And there's lots of things that will change if we leave. And for me, I still come from a generation where I think that it's good the more you have, you know, not just trade negotiations and trade agreements, but I like the fact that there's a bit of a cultural exchange. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's not just about migration, that's just about feeling part of something bigger. I like countries to be distinct. I like them to have, you know, control over many of the things they do. But in the end, I don't mind feeling a bit European as well.
Mm. Yeah, I feel culturally tied to it, but I also feel that it is appallingly managed. You know, if it were a company, it would have gone bust. If it was even the BBC, it would have been taken.
But I wonder
why.
That's really interesting what you say, Andrew. I wonder why people don't seem, whether they don't want to or they're unwilling to make that more of that cultural argument, because it's quite powerful, I would imagine. But that's not something that's articulated very much. Certainly, maybe that's a UK.
No, I don't think it's articulated. It all comes down to, you know, what do you think of migration? What do you think about, you know, the pound in your pocket? But in fact, there is a broader debate about it, and it's harder to kind of nuance, but I think that's the more interesting thing. And I think, oddly, for many people, especially many young people who, you know, travel back and forth to Europe for work, or who go there for holidays, or have aunts or uncles who live on the Costa del Sol, in the end, they'll think, how do I actually feel about Europe? And I think that's the bit that, in the end, politicians should be talking about, because I think it will engage people in a more interesting way. Anyway, that's my two pennies worth.
And very interesting to hear it. Well, we're an internationalist bunch, as people will probably have detected from that, and we'll look to the skies. There's a few interesting things happening in the skies around the globe. At Changi, from Tuesday, Asia's largest aerospace and defence exhibition. We'll be getting some reports, because we're very interested in what happens in that environment.
Sound up, so there'll be some zooming.
probably.
Will that be object. Nolan back with that voice?
Oh, God. In fact, we won't be covering that.
What's going to
We won't be hearing anything from
When's the next time you're going to see Nolan Giles face to face?
I'm going to just put
give it a year.
I'm going to put never out there.
Christmas party 2017.
Yeah, okay. Maybe. Yeah. But here's one, looking to the skies.
Yep.
Slightly more out of left field, Rob. I'm looking to you. I don't know why. It's the International UFO Congress Convention and Film Festival.
The truth is out there, Tom. I've been telling you for years.
From Wednesday in Arizona, of course, near Area 51, whatever it's called. All sorts of things. The technology, the cover-ups, alleged. The exopolitics. I don't know what that is.
That means talking on brandy.
That's good.
That's what that means.
Black ops, crop circles, alien visitations. There'll be speakers.
Crop circles.
I hope I said. There will be speakers there, Rob, who have experienced alien abduction.
Ah, I love it. Is Robbie Always Williams going to be there? Robbie Williams had a phase, didn't he? Everyone's had a phase, haven't they? All famous people have kind of gone to LA.
Alien abduction.
Got high, got clean, and then gone. Actually, it was UFOs the whole time.
Exactly. And there's lots of probing along the way.
Lots of probing Always. Along the way.
The aliens are so interested in.
They love.
All
probing.
Kinds of all different sorts of probing.
Exactly. They will
That's
tear
the
you a new
one. That's the question I'd ask if I
can I be probed?
If I met them in Arizona. No. I would just say, what can you establish? You've got the technology to come and visit us here on Earth. Mm. Some might say, what can you establish with probing that your super advanced technology can't divine from without? I don't want to get bogged down in a nest of probing vipers. What have I got next? Well, that leads me on elegantly, almost impossibly, to what's happening next Saturday. Okayama, Japan. The Saidiji Temple. There's a Hadaka Matsura, a naked festival.
Right.
It's a Shinto festival, Ayu. Lots of rituals, 500 years old or more.
Mm.
9,000 men dressed in loincloths compete to catch one of two wooden pieces of stick, shingi, dropped from the shrine's main hall. Those who catch the sticks are the lucky men of the year. But there's a little bit of international hysterica. I know you like those ones.
I do. I like all those kind of strange, sort of slightly pagan. Well, that's a Shinto festival. It's not pagan, is it? But I like all those sorts of things. Was that one of your favourite ones, Andrew? I felt like I kind of like the cheese rolling more than the stick. Dropping.
Because I think we talked.
Andrew, shut up.
No, I was here for the cheese. I'm looking forward to potentially entering some of our correspondence in some of these events in the future.
Hey, there's a monocle short book.
Henry Reese Sheridan would be, I think.
He'd be very good at that.
He's quite an amusing character, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he has youth on his side. What do you think, Andrew?
Let's send him to Japan.
Or Tom Reynolds. He'd be good.
I think Tom Reynolds might be a bit brittle in the competitive arena, I worry.
I think he might suffer from ill health halfway through the contest and have to be sort of vacuum packed home. Medivac'd, I mean. Not vacuum-packed. I'm going back to the Frey Bentos again.
Exactly. It's a constant refrain. There we are. Those are my news snippets for the week. It was a romance free zone. I'm sorry about that.
I think the sort of band of brothers that we share between us, that sort of beautiful bonhomie, that Bruderschaft, if you will. Has borne us out, and happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day to you both, gentlemen.
Michael Pepiot has been a leading art critic and writer since the 1960s, holding posts such as arts editor at Le Monde and writing for titles ranging from the New York Times to the FT. But it's as a scholar of his friend, the artist Francis Bacon's work, that Pepiot's writing has found many fond readers. He wrote the definitive Bacon biography, Anatomy of an Enigma, in the early 90s and published a follow-up memoir in 2015.
Now, a couple of days ago at the post-war and contemporary evening sale at Christie's, Michael parted with a Bacon work that was not only a treasure for his own collection, but one of the pieces that has helped define art in the latter 20th century too, Two Figures. The painting went under the hammer at Christie's on Thursday, and Michael joins us now to tell us how the sale went, why Bacon was a master, and presumably dish some dirt as well, possibly, between the lines. Michael, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
And we should say congratulations And commiserations, in a way, I suppose, for the sale of two figures.
Yes, I mean, it's always, it's something of a wrench. You know, I've had the painting all this time, and quite frankly, I haven't had it because it became too expensive for me to have. You know,
to have
like
in your sitting room,
yes, exactly. Yeah. It's like giving me a Rolls Royce or something. You know, what do I do with a Rolls Royce?
Sorry, I saw it in the drive outside Midori House. We've got our man keeping his eye on it for you.
Yes, that's it. Yes, and he's got other bacons in the boot. I couldn't really afford to insure it, so I've really lent it to museums and to exhibitions over the last 10 years or so. And, you know, I'm getting into a certain age where you start thinking about putting your affairs in order, if that's the, well, no, your affairs in order. I've done that, haven't I? I've done my, I don't have affairs anymore.
I was going to say, that was going to be my third question.
So, not my affairs in order, but my sort of, what's it called, estate planning. I've got two children, you know, they're sort of in their 20s, and I thought this might be a good time to part with this marvellous work, and part I did, and it all went very, very quickly. I've been thinking about this for 20 years, and the whole thing took, I think, about 1 minute 30 seconds. It was there, and then suddenly it wasn't there, and they were talking about somebody, some other picture, and I thought, what happened? I had no idea. It went so quickly, and of course the sums, you know, I mean, I'm not used to sums like that. I'm not sure you are either, and you suddenly realise that they're going up in £100,000. Yeah. So it's quite sort of impressive.
Michael, it went for north of £5 million.
Yes.
But the nature of Bacon's work is being extraordinary. I guess only in the UK, only someone like Lucian Freud would be similar. The way that those paintings have gone up in value and have become so essential to our understanding of you know, of the 20th century's art world.
Absolutely.
You know, did the number that it got, and you know, the life you knew, the Bacon you knew, the hanging out in the Colony Rooms, did those two things seem a bit disconnected at some point?
Totally disconnected. I'm not sure they've got anything. I mean, I'm delighted. Obviously, I'm delighted that it sold well, but I'm delighted too that Francis continues to go from strength to strength, even when I knew him, which, you know, he was already in his 50s. It was 1963 that we met. He was still a very, very controversial figure, and people were literally horrified by Bacon paintings. You know, I mean, I once saw a woman in a museum cover her eyes when she came across a Bacon, and I was actually meeting Bacon, and when I told him, he said, "Oh, good." Yeah. So he was still able to shock. But at the time when I first met him, he was a very, very controversial figure. And of course, although I think some people realized his importance, and he was already making relatively high figures for his paintings, but they were nothing. Nothing like this. Nothing.
And can you put your finger on the contemporary art world's fascination with this master? Is it to do with scarcity of work? Is it to do with the visceral nature of these canvases?
Yes, it's to do with power. It's to do with the fact, I think I can put that, because I've been lucky enough to live with Bacon paintings, you can't stare them down. Most things, when you put it up on the wall, they might be, you know, very harmonious, very attractive, very interesting images, but they tend to sort of fade a bit into the wallpaper even. But Bacon never fades. It's like a presence. It's like something living. For me, the comparison is with Van Gogh, because somehow Bacon managed to load so much energy and vitality into the brushstroke that it continues. It's quite spooky. It continues to live in the paint. So you have these images that are still battling with themselves on the canvas many, many decades later. And that's a very rare thing, I think. An artist whose work continues to sort of live and breathe and have anxiety fits canvas.
If you've got a Bacon on your wall and it goes with your interior decoration, you know you've got a problem of taste there. You know, you've got some shocking cushions.
Yes. Well, he's a marvellous painter.
Michael, beyond kind of living with those pictures in your home, you've kind of lived with, you know, the man and the myth for many, many years as well. As we said, you've chronicled his life on many occasions. You've become the person that people go to kind of understand him in many ways. And you had a tempestuous and unusual relationship. Mm. I think you've said before that everybody, like yourself, was a little bit in love with him.
Yes.
He was a bit jealous at the end when you had children.
Yes.
So a stormy relationship as well.
A bit jealous. He went white with rage.
Because
he thought he was going to have a fit.
Your undivided affection.
I can't really explain it. The odd thing with Francis is that he was attracted to straight men, and I think he always thought that eventually they would, he could sort of turn them, as it were, and that was part of the attraction he had in my regard. But, you know, we knew each other for 30 years. So, I mean, he probably realised at one point it wasn't going to happen, but we continued to be close friends. And he was always very elegant and easy with my girlfriends. And when I got married, he was a bit sceptical about that, I guess. But, I mean, I talk about all this in Francis Bacon in Your Blood, you know, this memoir that I published a couple of months ago. And what I try to describe is this strange relationship with a genius, because that's the real interest. And that's the only interest, in a sense, that I have, is that I think I knew this man very well. I certainly spent an enormous amount of time with him, and we talked through the night very often, just the two of us. So, and he had a huge effect on me. I mean, when you meet somebody like that, you're changed. You know, you pass through the fire, as it were, and you come out altered. I mean, I don't know whether it was for the better or the worse, but you're changed.
I want someone to do a sketch of your face in the studio when you were describing what he was like with your girlfriend and your wife. That's worth a portrait as well. I wanted to ask you about being a scholar and then being a friend of a great artist as well. Does that chop and change? Does staying up until dawn chatting with Francis Bacon go into the book, or is that sort of a different sit down turn on a tape recorder type of situation?
That is what the book's about.
It's the late nights, absolutely.
Yeah. And what it was like to be close to somebody so exceptional. I wrote the biography and I wanted to do something fairly formal, fairly, as it were, with some sort of distance. This book, there's no distance. It's very close to me, and I just wanted to sort of get that a bit out of my system, because he's a haunting presence. That's why, at the end I say, once Francis Bacon is in your blood, he'll be there forever. It's true.
You did a great collection of interviews with other great men of the arts and architecture, even people like Oscar Niemeyer. Mm. Has part of your fascination been to find that nub of what makes somebody great at what they do?
I really love to, you know, some people are more interesting to interview, even, you know, intelligent and successful and hugely creative and inventive people. Some people are easy to interview, other people are very difficult. And in that book of interviews, you know, I would say about two-thirds were easy and a third were difficult. But I'm fascinated by the interviewing process, and I love to try and catch a personality, as it were, in an interview, which is what you're doing. I just think it's a fascinating thing. It's a dialogue, and it's a way, perhaps, of getting into another person's world, thoughts, etc., very quickly and succinctly.
You mentioned Francis Bacon's sort of possession. You know, he wanted all your undivided attention, alluding to. He was quite a competitive artist amongst other artists as well.
Sure.
Quite a sort of a lovably selfish streak, or maybe not lovably,
yes,
but certainly a selfish streak.
He was totally egocentric in that.
Did you not say something about Picasso? When Picasso pops off, I'll be the best. I'll be the king, or something. There was something along those lines.
No, I think I was, and I was playing with fire here. I mean, it was towards the end of, towards the end of Francis' life, perhaps about 5 or 6 years before he died. But the Tate did a second retrospective, and he was called the greatest living painter. Right. And so we were having a slightly sort of acid conversation, and I said something, and I was sailing close to the wind here. I said, well, you would say that now that you're the greatest living painter, Francis. And I sort of then sort of ducked, thinking I'd get a real sort of, the real rough side of his tongue. But he caught it beautifully. And he said, quite sort of amiably, well, there's not much competition, is there?
Waspish to the last.
And when you look at the way the art world has, you know, remained, you know, vital, exciting, all sorts of extraordinary people, when you look at today's art world, of course, extraordinary characters, interesting people, but do you feel that there's anybody today who matches up to Bacon, who will be for today what he was at his time?
These people are very rare phenomena. They pop up a few times a century. So you can't really expect occurrence like that. And of course, it could come in any shape or form. It could be in any of the arts, or God knows, in science, or you know, really deeply inventive people who mark their times. But they are very, very rare phenomena. And I'm sure there are lots of brilliant artists and writers, and what can I say? I think it's, in Bacon's case, it was such a strange combination of talents and a kind of recklessness, daring, and somebody who, you see, because I think he captured things not only of his time, but from the whole of history. He said to me once, I think in my art, I go back to very early times. I hear a long call to antiquity. And possibly he re-expressed a very ancient sentiment of Greek tragedy or something like that, that, you know, still reverberates in the world. I think he probably had very, very extraordinary powers, psychic powers, perhaps. I don't know, and I'm talking nonsense, but it's very difficult to explain, and I don't think you can really compare. There'll be other brilliant people, but they'll come in a completely different form.
Well, as we started off talking about two figures, congratulations and commiserations, congratulations is what we really mean, are on the sale at Christie's this week. And Michael Pepiat, thank you again for your time today. Thank you.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Time for some box fresh Nordic pop now. This is Bulush from Oslo with When Love Is Alive.
Well done, Rob. You're quite good at pronouncing your Nordic act. I like that. That's Siri Nielsen.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, very cool.
Would you dance to that? Would you be seduced to that, Andrew?
That's quite a good. I think that's quite a good romantic Valentine's Day record.
I think you could have that on during a romantic dinner. It's got a sort of sexy beat to it. You could be listened to by candlelight. You could probably be performed a striptease to it.
And we should say that...
So, Andrew, just changed the subject.
I'm not doing a sexy striptease to you again, Rob. I did it at the beginning of the show. Oh. You got all these tricks. Now, we should tell people that Blush is B-L with an O struck B-L, through S-H.
One of those Nordic O's, yeah. Blush, When Love Is Alive. That's fantastic, isn't it?
I loved it.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
Cinema goers and critics alike are currently enjoying the latest production from Italian director Luca Guadagnino. It's called A Bigger Splash, and it stars Tilda Swinton, Ralph Fiennes and Dakota Johnson on the remote Italian island of Pantelleria, where an erotically charged thriller amid beautiful scenery unfolds.
Guadagnino's previous works include I Am Love and The Protagonist, and he's also well known for frequently collaborating with one of the finest actors in the business, the aforementioned Swinton. Rob sat down with Luca a little bit earlier to bring his filmmaking approach into focus.
There is a saying in Italy that says, the hell is paved with good intentions. So it's very important that you combine the good intentions with also a very strong discipline in achieving that intentions. And for a movie like A Bigger Splash, that is a contained world of four people kind of digging into one another, The thing that for me was the most, the thing I was most fearful about was to make some sort of self-indulgent, lounging kind of film. And that's why I had this intuition in which a great part was played in my ideas by the concept of an electric rock and roll fever. Probably because I always admired the embodiment of a kinetic energy in Scorsese's films, where you see how his vision is in collision or is in rhythm with the actual feverish or drugged or whatever attitude the characters have.
There's a feeling, you're right, that's a feeling in A Bigger Splash as well, that everyone is almost acting on their tiptoes, that there is such a lot of movement in it. That everyone's ready to dance. And of course, there's fantastic music. There's opera in it. There's the Stones in it. Everyone's so ready for action in that film.
I also think it has to do with my desire for interpreting a script from the standpoint of behavior and using everything that is in the script as a tool instead of using as a terminal gate, you know, like... You have to start from there, not arrive there. And often you see in films that you have these great moments of dialogue that are driven by a simple act of drama. Where, in A Bigger Splash, I hope, you feel that these people are, in a way, alive, pulsating creatures that are, they go beyond the actual concept of dramatization and they are alive creatures.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, going back to creating the atmosphere in the film. There is such a sort of tangible atmosphere in that movie that basically everybody who watches this film will want to book a ticket and go to that island and hang out with those four people. Maybe.
I should have a percentage from the Bureau of Tourism of Pantelleria.
You should just set up a little Alitalia booking office for yourself. But I wanted to know how you create that mood on set, whether you have... You have La Traviata playing and you have Emotional Rescue playing. Or how do you achieve the atmosphere on set that bears itself out in the film?
Well, it's about a very extensive visual research that starts off from the environment we are telling the story about. So in this case, we were talking about the world of music and rock and roll, what had become of it. So we were looking at a lot of images of this. It was all about also the concept of It Girl, like, you know, like the It Girl in the web today that you find the bloggers, that was in a way the world of Penelope. It was about an imposed artifice to a very rugged landscape. So we were looking at how that plays. And I must say that the Los Angeles, South California imagery, that it's part of the round of paintings from Hockney around the Big Splash, was a great indication for us as well, you know, like how this architectural artifice sits on a very unhospitable, unwelcoming landscape. So that,
and in terms of those paintings, you painted the swimming pool with the squiggles that appear in the Hockney painting, which I only noticed when I watched the movie again last night, actually. But there's a lot of detail in this film.
I am a cinephile. I like cinema. I like movies. I am of that class of people. And the pleasure of film for me is the one in which I can see a movie so many times and always never be bored. Actually, always discover things. I'm still discovering things in film that I saw for many times, like Fritz Lang, that I rewatched recently, The Scarlet Street. That was like, oh my God, this is like the 10th time I see it, but still I have something new to discover. So I try and I push all the collaborators to make sure that there is not a immediacy to the images we are creating, but there is a layer to it. And so either it's a detail, like you pointed out, which is the squiggles in the pool, it's a color, it's a juxtaposition, it's a movement or anything. Still, I think that it's important that you try to create layers with your image. Another thing that is crucial is also to be very, very practical and to really deal with the reality of the place. So there was a very funny moment in which I was fighting with my production designer, Maria Jurkovic. Because Maria, in a way, having this great mindset of someone who forges world by creating them, she couldn't understand why we couldn't build, for instance, the bedroom of the couple in a place that wasn't fit for that, with all glasses and stuff. But for me, it wasn't possible because that would have meant to overcome the realism and the nature of the place with an idea that was cinematic for itself. And for me, that was it's a great scene when you have these... sometimes I'm described as a director of style, which I hate because I hate style.
It doesn't mean there's no substance. It means people love looking at it.
People think like, oh, yeah, he's glossy, can do beautiful images. The truth is that when you deal, I do what I have to do in regard of what is the story who ask for it. So if we have made a room all of glasses for the bedroom, that would have been a huge mistake because Pantelleria, it's such a windy place. There cannot exist a room with windows because that is going to be smashed by wind in a second. So we were fighting about that and I was trying to push her to understand that. And then eventually we agreed that the room that has now is the room for the couple was the right one because it's a closed environment that is protecting the couple from the wind, actually.
I wanted to ask you a question, Luca, about the cast and about the script and how movable a feast those two things are. When you have a cast that seems so electric and so inhabit their roles so fully, how much the film changes when you know who you have in front of the camera?
Well, we should hold a debate with filmmakers and discuss this. How do you cast a movie? What are the priorities behind casting a movie? I would say that the first rule is bankability of the cast, unfortunately. Or often is the vanity of an actor wanting to be part of it or actually developing the idea for because it's a good role for him or her. And I'm not alien from this because for all my inclinations as a filmmaker to become part of the great tradition of the Robert Bressons, where he did not had actors, he only had what he called model of reality, I also have taught myself to love the star system and to love the fabric, the cloth upon which a movie in the commercial tradition are made with great recognizable faces and great dramatists, as sometimes actors can be. So I am living in a tornful condition, and I am trying to swim through the rules that are, in a way, indicative of how you can put together a movie. Having said that, I do believe that the cast of A Big Splash cannot be other than that, now that I've made the movie and I'm very happy with it. Regarding flexibility, maybe that's the word, between the cast and the script and the relationship with it. Well, I had the great privilege of having Dave Kajanik, the great writer who wrote this script, to be with me every day on set and to really make sure that reality was allowed to step in and so he could fit it in the script, in conversation with the actors, in conversation with the plays. You know, like often one thing that we do is to go to the location and to rewrite the script by the concept of the location so that one character can enter this room from that side and not like from an abstract idea of entering into the room.
The film is so skillfully written and so funny as well, but it just seems like there was some movable parts of that relationship for sure. When people get their hands on the script, you turn the music on that they're kind of feeding off of, perhaps on set and in the script. And then I suppose things change. And I wonder if, as a director, whether you feel that you're happy to lose a little bit of control there.
I'm super liberal.
Good. That's nice to know.
That being a liberal director means that you have a complete control. I have no complex. I don't have any kind of self-imposing complexes in my life. I'm a very easy person, and I'm at ease with myself. So I don't need to impose anything to anybody. Maybe what I impose people is what we have to eat, because I hate to eat something that I don't like, but that has nothing to do with my work. So I enjoy so much to experience what's happening in front of me by the actual beautiful teamwork that happens in front of me, that it then becomes a question of how we use the material. Like, you know, like a director is both a rhabdomant who's looking for the water, and it's also psychoanalyst who's taking things off from the internal part of the situation, the actors and the place and the film itself. You are a wanderer who is looking for water and also who's trying to make something out of people. And I think that's what I like to do, and that's what I'm asking myself. Clearly, to establish the ground for looking for water and psychoanalyze people and the place, you have to really prepare everything in advance. So that's why I'm having this very, very long preparation period of time in which I try to really carve out every single tool I can give this performance to play, for instance.
That was Rob speaking a little bit earlier to Luca Guadagnino. Coming up, a story of the post office, love, with Mr. Tim Ellison.
The Monocle Minute is a just-launched daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinion and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special cultural roundup at the weekends too. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
It's Valentine's Day, and whether you're having a special time with a loved one or simply wish we'd stop talking about one of the most sickly sweet cutesiest days on the calendar, just be thankful you're not the recipient of a vinegar Valentine. The slightly fiendish practice of sending a vinegar Valentine took place in the UK prior to the standardisation of the country's postal service in 1840. It meant that with wildly complicated tariffs, which back then were always paid by the recipient, not the sender, someone could send a slightly nasty note to an enemy or scorned lover. When it arrived, that unlucky recipient would also have to pick up the bill.
It's just one of the peculiarities that we're part of the forthcoming Postal Museum in London. And another highlight being unearthed from the past is the reactivation of a section of London's long silent mail rail, the train that delivered letters on its own private line beneath the city. Well, joining us now to tell us about mail rail, vinegar Valentines, and the unusual history of the UK's postal system is the museum's deputy director, Tim Ellison. Tim, welcome to the show.
Hi.
We should start with these vinegar Valentines, and I've looked on your site, a couple of good examples. They were slightly mean. And the trick was that, as we mentioned in the introduction there, the person receiving the mail had to pay for this rather insulting card.
Exactly. It's sort of an unfortunate double whammy, really. You get the emotional hit and also the financial one as well. So, I thought you summed it up well.
And how rude were these cards?
Some of them are quite bad. I mean, you know, kind of very Victorian in their in their abuse, but they were still quite abusive.
And just tell us, these form just part of a huge collection that you're going to be displaying at this new postal museum. Who has held this extraordinary collection of mail, and who has continued to gather it then?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the moment, the collection sits within the old boiler room of the Mount Pleasant building in Clerkenwell in the middle of London. It's one of the drivers for the project is to get it into a much better home. It's underground and next to the River Fleet, and we have some great collections there, some great stories. We want to protect them going forward, and we want to be able to allow the public to really enjoy them and really get something out of them.
And I know you go right back to the kind of dawn of the postal system in the UK. Is there a sense that with the timing of the museum opening, with Mount Pleasant kind of being a shadow of its former self, and that building is one of the greatest buildings in London, one of the most amazing sort of 4 or 5 acres of real estate and space in London. Does it feel, though, that we're kind of beginning to talk about the mail in the past tense generally, and that's why the museum exists?
Yeah, I mean, we prefer to talk about, and we do talk about sort of communication in a much broader form. And, one of the things we really want to get across to people and help them to understand is how the British Postal Services were the forerunner. Really for all of our modern day communications that we have today. You know, it really sort of just so happens that the kind of the form of that communication for 100 years or so was the written form. And Britain played a sort of a major role in taking that to the world, really. And we sort of like to use the phrase that we brought literacy to millions. And through the sort of the empire that Britain had at that time, we played a huge role in that.
And I wanted to ask you also about the huge design heritage that goes with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you said for 100 years, it seems like, staggers me that it's only 100 years. Because, yeah. I mean, it feels like forever it was possible to lick the back of a stamp, put an envelope, put in a handsome red pillar box and be on your way. I guess that wasn't always the case. But the design heritage of it is presumably very important. And that's one of the things that you, as a director and curator, are zeroing in on, isn't it?
Yeah, the design is a fantastic sort of wealth and you know, definitely not the sort of things you would expect. You know, with the Postal Museum, so yep, of course we have stamps, and we have a lot of.
They've got stamps, Andrew.
Yeah, it's official. We had to, but what we don't have, we're not a postal museum in a kind of, you know, pull out racks of stamps sense. You know, what we've tried to do is really embody, sort of embed them into the kind of the stories and use the collections to tell a story. And what we think we do is tell a story that will be familiar to many people over the last sort of 500 years, but tell it from a unique kind of viewpoint. And that's definitely what we can offer. And I guarantee there's a surprise or two along the way. And we kind of like the challenge of getting people to think differently about a postal museum.
So tell us one of the two things that are in the collection which you think would surprise people about the mail and its history.
Absolutely. Well, just picking up on the design point, which I probably didn't quite answer. I mean, there's a wealth of sort of poster material from the 1930s at really the sort of the birth of mass communications. And the GPO, as it was at the time, was absolutely vital in sort of developing a lot of those communications, advising people how to use new technologies such as sort of microwave technologies, the telephone and so on. And, you know, we have instructional videos from the GPO film unit, who are a very important bunch of people.
See, I love stuff like that. Yeah, the old films, kind of almost public information.
Absolutely. And Mail Rail, of course, is the one that people know very well. And
sounds kind of like a bar, at Vauxhall Bar. Am I allowed to say that? Mail Rail?
You can say it. We may well pass it off as our own in the future. But, you know, they were the, that group of people really were the first sort of, you know, first UK documentary makers. Yeah. And they went on to then be vital in the war effort and produced, I think the figure is something staggering, like 7,000 films in support of the war effort. So, again, I think that would be a surprise to a number of people.
I guess the other thing, we'll go on to talk about this rail line in a minute, but something that's always surprised me, I've got a huge pile of postcards that I think inherited from a granny somewhere along the line.
A lot of people say that. Yeah,
but the interesting thing that strikes me about them is on the backs of them, they say, it's kind of like, just like two or three lines off it, it'd be like, I'll be home for tea at 5 tomorrow. Exactly. So it was like sending an email. And also, already like 1910, 1920, the reliability of the mail, that you could pop something in the post and that you could, you know, guarantee someone would turn up for a meeting. So the speed of the mail was always something amazing.
Absolutely. And the scale of it as well, exactly that. So one of the best examples I've come across is during the First World War, obviously, you know, vital for those communication lines to be kept open. And the post office at the time built what was the biggest wooden structure in the world at that time in Hyde Park, just as a temporary sorting office to manage the vast quantities of mail. And at that time, you know, we've got records from, I think it's Wilfred Owen, who was born in a sort of a rural Shropshire community. That community had something like 11 collections per day at that time. So, you know, exactly as you say, we have examples of people corresponding multiple times across just one day. And hence that point about very much, you know, the forerunner for our modern communications that we have now.
I don't want to be too the one show here. Listeners overseas, Google it. But I was looking forward to coming and visiting the press view of the Post Museum. Yeah. And in that material, I read something about cats having jobs.
Yes.
And now that clearly is a question that needs to be asked.
Definitely.
Tim, fill us in on cats having jobs in the post office.
Yeah, so this is the kind of the quirky, cool stories that we have, exactly. So, you know, we have sick notes from animals. The animals were employed by the post office in various guises.
Pigeons?
Do you know, I don't know about pigeons. No. It seems a pretty logical assumption. But the example with cats was the common one, I think. Well, when I say common, there's examples of it.
So you have too many pigeons.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, exactly. Or certainly too many mice nibbling at vital parts of mail, I think. So cats, definitely. And then a horse's sick note, which is the, you know, the favourite one that we have, which is, I think the horse was sort of signed off for sore shoulders, which is, you know, I think a pretty reasonable, you know, good reason to be off.
Now, we were going to quiz you about the train as well. So there used to be a mail train that ran underneath London, delivering mail to all the sorting offices.
Absolutely.
But that was kind of, it was not that long ago, 20 years ago, I guess, retired. But you're kind of bringing a bit of it back to life.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a vital part of the Postal Museum offer as a whole. So, yeah, Mail Rail ran from Paddington to Whitechapel from 1927 to 2003. So, as you say, quite recently. And it's since been mothballed, and it sat there as a redundant asset, you know, or a liability, depending on your viewpoint. And we've really hope we've turned it into a fantastic asset. So what you'll be able to do is visitors will be able to go on a 15-minute ride. There'll be a lot of sort of audio visual, kind of a really immersive sort of experience. And there'll be a sort of a recreation of various sort of events through history. So it could be the, you know, the London Blitz, for example, where all the lights will go out, the bomb sounds will go off, it will, and the power will gradually be restored. Through to a sort of an explanation of what the network did, the people who ran that network. You know, 300 people worked on that. It ran 22 hours a day, and it ran 365 days a year, carrying 4 million letters every day. Again, it's back to that point of scale.
And why was it retired in the end? It was just not needed, or?
I think really what happened is the underground network, obviously, was in a very fixed position, and it connected, as you said, sorting offices to mainline train stations. So the letters would then go on to travelling post offices, which, back to the Merrill point, would travel the length and breadth of the country. And eventually that above ground world changed. The connection stopped to the travelling post offices going from Paddington, and the sorting offices got closed. So if you like, the kind of the route that it served really became changed, and the tunnels couldn't change with it.
Timings. When are we be able to go on the train? When will we be able to come to the museum?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I did see that the museum.
You can get it to work.
It says children are going to be allowed to play being a postman. I want to do that.
You can. Yeah, not just children. We have a number of people on our staff who absolutely love doing that. So next year is the answer. Yeah, we're hoping to be open in time for Easter. So,
and just in terms of your directorship, what are your benchmarks? Because this is obviously such a specific subject matter for a museum, but also so much human interest. It's touched everybody's lives in so many ways, and it's been relied upon. Do you have to fly around the world looking at sort of things that have not postal museums, but other museums that share a similar kind of that bore down into human interest?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a, you know, Morel in itself is unique, absolutely, and you know, unique is a word that gets overused in museum terms, but it's genuine in this case. We've done a fair bit of benchmarking. Yeah, I mean, there's some really good stuff happening in museums at the moment. So, you know, technology really seems to be changing the way that museums can deliver to their visitors. It opens up the sort of the possibilities. A good example that the Science Museum, working with David Attenborough and producing sort of 3D visualizations of, you know, of underwater environments. We actually did the same with Mailrail. We actually did a 3D mapping project to scan the entire network, actually. So even though we'll only take visitors to a small example of the network, they'll be able to explore all of it in digital format, actually, and I think museums that embrace that are really the ones that we've tried to follow.
And when you went for the job interview for this,
that was a while ago.
But wait, this is one of those rare moments where you needed a kind of a camera in here, because you don't look like somebody who would be typically kind of going after a job to do with the Mail. You've got a good beard. You've got a good East London.
I didn't have the beard when I first got
good,
the job.
Good East London haircut. But what drew you to this world? Your passion for museums.
You could get a tube from Whitechapel straight to Paddington.
Yeah, easy, exactly. It was the transport. It was the transport that swung it.
So. Museums or collecting or telling stories. What's your passion for this?
Do you know? For me, it was.
Or you are a stamp collector?
No. I'm not a stamp collector. I'm afraid. Sorry to disappoint on that score, but thanks for the beard comment as well. No. For me, it was wanting to do something with longevity, with some permanency, actually. And you know, we're building something that will exist long after I finish with the organisation, and you know, hopefully for many, many years going forward. You know, I think we have some great stories. I really want to tell them. And I think it's quite a, I don't know, it's sort of quite a noble kind of pursuit, really. And I want to be able to walk past that building in years to come and kind of go, yeah, I, you know, played a role in making that happen, really. And yeah, that does it for me.
Beautiful.
Brilliant.
Lord Ellison. Tim Ellison there.
One day.
Co-director of the upcoming Postal Museum. It's going to open in 2017. Stay tuned. For the meantime, stay tuned to us. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, we've shuffled our papers, we've shuffled our guests, we've done a frankly disgusting Valentine's Day bit of kind of horniness at the beginning of the show.
And we've stuck a stamp on it too.
A single entendre. We've licked the back of it and we've sent it off. What do you think?
I had a very nice time today, actually.
I really enjoyed our guest. Michael Pepiat was always fantastic value. Luca Guadagnino, it was great to meet him earlier this week. He's fantastic. That new movie is fantastic. I should pat everybody on the bottom and tell them to go and see it. Valentine's Day or none. It's sexy times. But it's also dark times. And I've got a bone to pick with Ralph Fiennes, the fantastic star of that movie, who plays a kind of hairy, leery rock manager. I once went dancing around Shoreditch House with Ralph Fiennes, completely by accident. Emotional Rescue by the Rolling Stones was on. And then we got the lift down together and we kind of sort of eyeballing each other and sort of saying, you know, hi, that was fun. Going down, by the time we got down, you know, he drove off in his car. I wandered around the corner to my old house. What do I see? What is the centerpiece of this movie? Ralph Fiennes dancing to the Stones' Emotional Rescue. I think he's nicked my moves.
No.
Honestly.
Amazing.
Yeah. So all I'd like our listeners to go and see this movie because it is fantastic. But also maybe just, you know, kind of a couple of checks in the post wouldn't go amiss.
Ah, oh, Mr. Funny, Fiennes. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We had an amusing time. One of those things where you kind of stalk each other around the dance floor, like, I'm sure I know you. Anyway, that's that. And wasn't Tim Ellison fun at the Postal Museum?
And I know it's a stupid thing to say, but he so doesn't look like a post office kind of museum person. Cool. No, kind of cool guy.
Not a red satchel inside.
Cool guy, and he had a nice tale to tell as well.
He didn't like my joke about the mail rail being a...
He did. I was
protecting him, weren't you?
I was protecting him. I was protecting our guests.
Okay.
From badinage.
We should thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall, researched by Charlie Monaghan, and made with little help from Alex Funnell. Our studio manager was, of course, Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.